don't want what we know out there.
How a person can go from really almost nothing to becoming a millionaire by owning rental properties.
He would always buy these flip houses, and I just remember thinking, this guy is crazy. Why would he buy that house?
In the past decade, there's been a huge surge in the peer-to-peer short-term rental market.
Become an insider. So you have to know the rules before you get the game.
Every second counts. So make every second count.
Welcome to the Real Estate Jam. Whether you're just beginning or the best of the best, we're glad you're here. We will share successes, failures, and strategies for the action-taking real estate investor. And now to your hosts, JD and Melissa.
Hey guys, welcome to the Real Estate Jam podcast. I'm JD, and I'm here with two of my absolute favorite real estate agents. Of course, the lovely and talented Miss Melissa.
Hey, JD.
How are you, bud?
Great. I'm excited because we got Matt on our podcast.
I'm excited to reintroduce you guys to Matt Rohr Gardner. Matt and Melissa run an EXP team of somewhere between 15 and 30 agents, depending on what day of the week it is. And, you know, probably a lot less than that coming up, but we'll get into that. Matt, thanks so much for finding time with us this morning. I think we got a really important topic that's going to affect everybody, investors and real estate agents. It's changing kind of the dynamic of real estate. But for those in our audience who maybe don't know your story, can you give us the brief rundown? And then hopefully we can talk about this new NAR ruling.
Sure. Yeah. Matt Gardner, prior Air Force pilot and transitioned to real estate now. So doing full-time real estate investing, trying to get my hands dirty in as many niches as possible on the investing side. Which is great. So we do syndications. We jumped into short-term rentals, long-term rentals, medium-term rentals, flips, RV parks, mobile home parks. I haven't done self-storage yet, but I'm actually underwriting one now. So we'll see if I jump into self-storage next. And then on the sales side, like you said, Melissa and I, we run a team. Sometimes the big team, sometimes the little team, depending on how many agents want to quit or join for that week. It's feast or famine sometimes with agents. So
sure.
Well, I'm super excited to talk about the NAR lawsuit. And, you know, you just said about it will affect agents. But, you know, I was on an inspection yesterday with Dan, the man, and Dan, I didn't even think about Dan. He goes, I'm just scared to death about this just because it'll affect me so much because most of my clients are agents. And I didn't even think about the other people who are in trades that it will affect a lot.
I think that's a good point. But before we really deep dive into that, let's just kind of explain what the original lawsuit was, what happened, and then now what just happened a couple of days ago. So Matt, for those in our audience who maybe don't know about the lawsuit, can you kind of give us a breakdown of what the original lawsuit was and what that ruling was?
Yeah, sure. So it's all about NAR. We keep saying NAR, which is the National Association of Realtors, which is basically, I like to equate it to the mafia of real estate. It's the program that you don't have to be a part of, but you have to be a part of kind of to be in traditional residential real estate. They have traditionally acted as the mafia in that sense, and the fact that they gave us protection, right? They protected us from a lot of these liabilities, a lot of these lawsuits, of just kind of giving us a nice, safe environment to work. However, there was effectively a class action lawsuit against the National Association of Realtors that said we were effectively price fixing and forcing sellers to pay commissions to buyers' agents. And the whole problem was it was this forced obligation to pay buyers' agents. That's what the ruling came down. They were like, this is not okay to force a seller to pay a buyer's agent. Because the way it worked was we threw our properties on the MLS, the multiple listing service, where we as agents could all see that data. And the one obligation that we had up until, you know, that point, basically, is you had to offer compensation to a buyer's agent in order to put your house on the MLS, even if it was just a dollar, right? Even some nominal amount, you still had to offer compensation. A lot of MLSs had slowly shifted to being, hey, no, you can just offer $0, no commissions required. I think that was in a way to appease it. But in the end, the lawsuit came down and said, no, this is not OK. So that's kind of the way it worked for them. The big thing with that commission that was offered on the MLS, it was unilaterally offered, meaning you know, if Melissa showed a house to somebody and that's all she did, open the door, and then the listing agent ended up doing all the work, but Melissa was tagged as that buyer's agent, she would still do whatever that contracted, yeah. you know, whatever the MLS was advertising as that commission, she would do that money legally with the way we kind of had it set up. But that is that's what's going away now. So that unilateral compensation is going away.
Right. And so with that, they ruled against them, and then they found a judgment against NAR, and it was a lawsuit against NAR and some of the bigger brokerages in the industry, you know, the names that everyone knows when they think of real estate agents, and they awarded them. Do you have any idea what it was? Like some ungodly $1 billion award.
So it was basically, they're coming down, it was some multiple $1 billion, $2 or $3 billion, some yeah. crazy amount that was not going to be able to be paid. Like it was an unreasonable amount of money that they were trying to charge. And as a small aside before we jump into it, it's like I find this so funny that the attorneys who are behind the scenes here, you know, like they're touting like we are the attorneys for these people who are being forced to pay these ridiculous commissions. Meanwhile, they're taking 40% of the net here. And they're making, you know, if it would have been the $1 billion lawsuit, they would have talked about hundreds of millions of dollars these attorneys would have made. Yeah. And in the end, the class action lawsuit, the people who are actually, you know, trying to earn money through what they felt was undue compensation, they were only going to make a couple grand.
Yeah.
You know, like it was just kind of ridiculous. So,
yeah, that is funny that the lawyers are the ones that are going to catch the biggest benefit out of this. Okay. So then NAR came out and said, hey guys, we still don't agree with this lawsuit. We're going to appeal. Don't worry, we have your best interest at heart. That's what they said initially. And this is the part that makes me absolutely furious, because it wasn't like they said, hey guys, we're considering settling this suit. They didn't say that. The message that NAR was putting out is, hey, we're going to fight this for you. That's what we get paid for. That's what your dues go to. Is this trade organization so that we can take you guys and protect you. And then about 3 days ago or four days ago now,
Friday.
They came out with a cloudily worded message that said, hey, surprise, we're going to settle this for $418 million.
And it's in your best interest.
And it's in your best interest. And we're going to change some of those rules. Can you talk about, Matt?
So you're right. In the end, the big bad mafia ended up bending over, basically. They conceded and they said, hey, man, we may actually be wrong here is what they, I don't know what the behind the scenes discussion had. It must have been a really interesting conversation back behind the scenes, because
billions of dollars that really.
So in the end, maybe they had a judge that was like, man, you're probably gonna lose this case. You need to settle, or whatever it happened to be.
Yeah.
They ended up saying, all right, well, let's offer this settlement. Right. And here's the terms of the settlement. Like you said, so $418 million paid over the next 4 years that they're going to have to, you know, pay as a judgment. And they also have agreed that they're going to remove all commissions out of all buyer's agent commissions out of the MLS. So that will no longer even be advertised. And the other additional change that's really a big change is the fact that now buyer representation has to be as clear as possible through some sort of a buyer broker agreement or buyer employment contract in order to make sure it's clear. The compensation, how people get paid, what the payment is going to be, and all that stuff.
Very similar to a listing agreement on the sell side or on the seller's side, but for the buyers. And I guess, you know, there was a couple of things. One, because I think there's so, as soon as I read that, I'm reading it one way, and then I start seeing all of these news articles, all of these agents freaking out on social media saying, hey, the 6% commission is gone. Home values are going to drop by this much. And all of that kind of stuff pushing out from the media, which I think is completely disingenuous on their part. The way that they are framing the clickbait to get their links read is completely different than what the actual NAR letter said, but they're just running with it. And it really, I think it is unethical reporting for sure. Oh, but
welcome to modern media, man. Yeah. Really, we're talking about mass media or anything. People are going to do whatever they can to be as clickbaity as possible. And ultimately, what it comes down to is there will be changes, right? Like, there's going to be changes. But this whole concept of having like a buyer-broker agreement, like an agreement with a buyer and a broker, is not old. I've been preaching to my team for years now to use these buyer-broker agreements because, like I said, even last year, there were plenty of listings that were only offering a dollar or a 0.5% or 1% to the buyer's agent. So it was in your best interest as a buyer's representative to have this agreement of compensation up front so that you were never limited to show a buyer an off-market property or a FSBO that wasn't offering compensation, or even a property on the MLS that's offering something less than what you think you're worth as a buyer's agent.
So, well, speaking of that, because I'm really, really on the fence about this, and we'll go into what the best practices are here in a minute. But the thing that I want to address is some of the potential problems that I see for this chosen settlement, which to be honest, it isn't approved yet. The judge that was overseeing the trial still has to approve the judgment the settlement before we move forward, which I think will probably happen if both sides agree to it and there is some compensation being awarded. I don't see how a judge could not unless there was something unethical in the agreement, and then maybe, The potential problems I see, number one, which is something near and dear to my heart, is a VA home buyer in the VA world. When you're purchasing a home with a VA loan, it says in there that you are legally not allowed to pay a buyer's agent.
Yep.
So what that is going to do in the short term, it's going to mean that the VA buyers are going to have a really hard time buying houses because they have to make the decision. Do I go into this transaction unrepresented or do I go through the listing agent who does not have my best interest at heart? And so really, and that's the VA loan. But then when you start looking at some of these other FHA 3% or 3.5% down loans for first-time homebuyers and lower socioeconomic class people, they don't have that. The reason that those loans, the FHA loan, the VA loan, all those loans are so, USDA and a couple of the other ones are so popular is because of the low or no down payment.
Yep.
Because it's hard for lower income people to save up enough money to have a down payment, let alone save enough money for a buyer's agent. So I think the real losers in this are, and I can't wait for that round of lawsuits, are the first time home buyer, a couple of young kids who just got married, looking to start a family, need to buy a home instead of throw their money away in apartment rent. Those people are going to be the ones who aren't represented, and that might, that's not necessarily Melissa's primary clientele in her retail business, but that is a significant portion for our area and all across the country. And I think those people are going to be hurt by this. Yep. And I would expect further lawsuits to come into effect, especially when the government is pushing like home ownership and how that's good for the economy and good for building wealth. Now they've allowed something that will actually prevent that from happening.
Yeah, I think the market's going to have to change to accommodate the current restrictions that they're proposing. And so do I think the VA is going to change the regulation on permitting buyers to pay for buyer's agents? Yeah, I think that's a pretty clear-cut, obvious change that's bound to happen here shortly, maybe even in a matter of weeks that might be the fastest change the VA has ever done.
Which that still might take 4 years.
Yeah. So significant pressure on the VA to remove that restriction right now. I've heard plenty of conversations about that with people trying to talk directly to the director of the VA in regard to that specific requirement. There are also discussions of wording, wordsmithing the contract to where even if the seller is willing to offer compensation to the buyer's agent, we can still make it work to where, the buyer's not technically paying that commission to kind of work around that in the near term. So that is a that is a hurdle that I think we can overcome relatively easily. The bigger hurdle in my mind is exactly what you're saying, kind of the low income, or really just people who are strapped for cash, who are in a position where they have to buy a house. Like that's a tough scenario to overcome. At the same time, I think the market is going to shift also to allow that to happen. How that shift's going to look, I don't know. Now remember, this settlement doesn't mean the seller can't pay commission right to the buyer's agent. It just means the offer of unilateral, meaning no matter what, the buyer's agent is going to get paid, that is going away. So as a buyer's agent, we can still negotiate that. But the problem now is, I come to you as a buyer, let's say Melissa's a buyer and she wants to buy a house. And she's like, hey, I only have 3.5% down for my FHA loan. That's all I have to afford is my down payment. And I say, okay, great. If I were to tell Melissa, I'll only work for, you know, a $500 flat fee as a buyer's agent, and we go and we try to negotiate a 3% fee for me as a buyer's agent from the seller, thinking I can make up the difference, you know, the seller paying that difference. The way the settlement is worded now, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot by that employment cap. That employment cap contract is now on a cap. So even if the seller is willing to offer me 3% and I've agreed and written down with Melissa that our agreement's only $500, I can only take $500, not the $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is.
Right.
And yeah, that was just crazy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So my thought, because of, you know, the way I was raised as an adult through the military and doing that, that's fine. What I do is just cancel out the contract that we signed and sign a new one for 3.5% with my buyer. I okay, so I can't do this. I'll do this. Or I sign a contract with all of my people that says, hey, we'll put it at 6% commission is what I'll get paid. And then if we're able to get the compensation from them, I'll change it on the back end or something like that. Now, that's probably skirting the spirit of that rule, but that's what I would
anticipate doing the same thing. Like if I feel like I'm a 4% agent and I deserve 4% for my job and my value that I bring to the table, I'll have them sign a 4% commission. But if the seller is only offering 3.5%, I may just, you know, swallow my pride and just take the 3.5% and have my buyer not pay anything. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
I anticipate that to be the case. Another change could totally be that these loans start to incorporate commission into the loans.
Yeah.
You know, lenders come down and they say, all right, here's an FHA loan, 3.5% down is all required, and we'll work a 2.5% commission into the buyer's agent as part of the loan. Almost kind of like the VA funding fee might just get wrapped into the loan as well.
Yeah, because they're just another part of the equation that will be affected by this as well, for sure.
Yeah. Like the home inspectors, mm-hmm. the appraisers. Well, I guess appraisers won't be affected too much because they're usually in the listing agent's pocket or in the listing or the lender's sphere of influence.
I think the bigger thing with the appraisers is right now the MLS offers very clear understanding of what fees are being paid or what. You know what I mean? So I go to log in the MLS, I can see who paid title, you know, at closing. I can see, you know, how much the commission was. And an appraiser can go on there and he can offset value if needed based on those additional fees and compensations and concessions that were offered. Now that these are all like behind the door negotiations that we're having between buyer and seller directly, it's going to be a little bit more complicated, I think, for the appraisers in order to justify value. Not a big shift, but there is going to be a little bit more variability there.
The other thing that I'm really worried about, and not that it's a problem right now, but I definitely see this being a problem, again, spurring more lawsuits in the future, is one of the great things about the way that it was, where the commission was listed, was that it was fair for everybody. Anybody who sold this house or brought a buyer to this house is 3%. But now, if we have, you know, a Hispanic real estate agent and a white real estate agent submitting offers onto a house, and the Hispanic agent is offered a concession of 1%, and the other agent is offered a concession of 3.5%. Now, you know, there's nothing directing that everything needs to be fair. So what I anticipate will happen is eventually somebody's going to have some discrimination cases where, hey, the female real estate agents are only getting 2.2% concessions paid, and male real estate agents are getting 3% commission or 3% concession for commissions, and stuff like that popping up, which was completely eliminated through
the transparency
mm-hmm. of being able to have it. And now it's not going to be like that. And I think
it's a double-edged sword, right? So for an agent who has done a good job of building their reputation and growing relationships within the industry, like there are certain agents, if they were to bring me offers now, like if Melissa were to bring me an offer versus some agent I've never met before, I would tell my seller, like, hey, Melissa's a super strong agent. I'm confident we can close this thing. You know, if she's asking 3.5% in the commission and it's within the budget of the seller, I'd be like, hey, totally worth it. I'm confident she can close. And if there's another offer out there that's only offering, asking 2% concession and everything, all terms else being kind of similar, I would still kind of push towards the person who I think is going to close.
Me too.
I hope my relationship and my reputation could help garner more payment. You're right, though. It's now creating this imbalance, right? I think it will by nature create an imbalance just by having that lack of transparency.
So what does this mean if we can explore for the investors in our audience? Mm-hmm. You know, what does this mean for them? What do they need to look at? And right now I'm especially thinking about flippers and then also like short-term rental investors and looking to purchase properties or sell their property.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, agents who are investors, for the agents who are freaking out right now, thinking like all the world's going to end, that tells me right away that like you have not built a firm enough foundation in your investments that you are so heavily reliant on these active sales, this active income, that you need to really double check yourself and focus more on creating this passive income, right? So first and foremost, this tells me right away, like I need to continue to focus more on investments versus relying on the mafia to protect me. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of my first takeaway. When it comes to, you know, full-time investors and how it's going to affect their sales, I think there is... There are definitely going to be interesting conversations you need to have. So from the acquisition side of the house, the investors who like to cast a wide net and work with 10 or 15 different agents in a certain area, I think it's going to be interesting because agents, this whole concept of the employment contract or the buyer broker agreement, typically what we sign is what we call an EBBA, exclusive buyer brokerage agreement, meaning exclusive, like you want to work with me, I'm going to work with you, and we're married up. This is a monogamous relationship, basically. You're not going to be dating around other agents. However, I expect some other more open relationship contracts to potentially be in the works. I think it's going to be one of the changes that we're going to see is a buyer brokerage agreement, but you know, you're with the understanding that you might be working with somebody else in the area as well. So there's going to be some interesting word crafting that's going to have to be done.
Yeah, I think what might be more common is the individual showing. So if I'm a buyer's agent, I find a property that I think fits my specific buyer. I shoot them over the contract that says, hey, I'm going to show you this house and we're in an exclusive relationship for just this house, not for all of the ones across the way.
Oh, for sure. We're going to play on the timing. We're going to play on the specificity of the contract. We were just talking before we started, right? Like even things like open houses for retail buyers, before you walk in that house, if I'm the listing agent running an open house, I'm not allowed to have anyone enter that house unless they have an employment contract with me or they have an employment contract with some other agent. Otherwise, they're going to go unrepresented. And there's really, it's almost a potential liability issue if I let them come in the house now and I'm not representing them or they're not represented in any regard. Going back to the investor side though, I think that's going to be an interesting piece from the acquisition side. There's going to be some interestingly crafted kind of employment contracts, agreements between buyers and brokers in order to kind of satisfy this requirement. I don't think it's going to shift a ton for them. I think they're going to find, investors are really good at finding the loopholes, right? And they're going to find the loopholes that kind of satisfy the requirement and move on from there. From the sales side, the disposition side of the house, this is really going to open up to pretty interesting conversations of, do we actually want to offer compensation to the buyer's agent? And if we do, how does that look? Because the way it's written now is we can't have that compensation listed in the MLS, but you can in your public remarks say, you know, seller willing to offer 2% towards concession, towards buyer's concessions or whatever. But as a listing agent, what do you do now? Have the conversation like, hey, here's what I think I'm worth. Do you still take a 5 or 6 or 7% listing and then you have the buyer like earn whatever they can earn? Or do you take a 2% listing and say, hey, don't pay the buyer's agent and I'm still going to sell your house? And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see kind of where it's at. That's the big unknown to me is like, what does this look like in 6 months and 9 months and 18 months? like once we normalize operations, it may just end up being status quo. It may be every listing's that 5-7% listing. And, you know, the standard is now we're just offering publicly, you know, hey, we're willing to offer, you know, 3% to the buyer's agent. Now, the biggest difference now, you still need to negotiate that. Still needs to be specifically in the contract now. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the disposition side ends up landing out. Like what is it going to be the new normal?
Yeah, but I know as a flipper and doing some of these flip projects that even, you know, the properties that I'm putting out there, even if we look at, okay, when I'm flipping a property, I have access to every single one of your buyers. I have access to every single one of Melissa's buyers and the rest of our 15 to 30 agent team. I have access to all of those. And to be honest, I could probably offer zero buyer's commission and have all those people see it anyway. But whether that's right or wrong, that, you know, it doesn't matter. But even offering compensation, me just showing it to that few of eyes will bring me a lower price. It doesn't entice buyer's agents to work hard for my listing, my sale. So the way I see it, and I've seen a ton of real estate investors from our group saying like, hey, this doesn't affect us. We're still going to be offering compensation. We might even offer more compensation for agents that are bringing us properties now than we would have before, because savvy investors understand the value that a good real estate agent brings. Because I think this whole fiasco really boils down to poor messaging, because the message that consumers were receiving was you have to offer a buyer agent commission, which has never been the case. It's always been negotiable, but a lot of the real estate agents are saying, hey, I understand that's negotiable. You can choose that if you want, but I'm not going to be the agent to work with you because I know the value that these other agents bring. Exactly. But the message that went out is that you have to pay a buyer's agent. And you don't have a choice on the fees, and that's just what it is. But that's never been the case. So the premise of the lawsuit to begin with didn't make sense to me. The policies were put in place to protect not just the seller, but the buyer consumer, and all of that stuff's out the windows. But getting back to a good and competent flipper understands the value that a good agent brings. And the other part of the messaging is that a lot of people see these real estate agents that are marketing and showing flashy cars and doing all this stuff that they're receiving $20,000 for just opening a door and filling out a contract that you could use ChatGPT to do. But that's the message that the general public has, but that is couldn't be further from, you know, and I know I've said it a million times. I hate real estate agents. And it's still true, but that doesn't mean that I don't realize the value that a good agent has. Because really what I should change that statement to is I hate bad real estate agents. And that happens to be the majority. There's 2 million real estate agents or something across the country. And the majority of them sold one house in the last 12 months. So those are more the agents that I'm talking about. But I know that they bring value through knowledge, market knowledge and experience, through networking, through, vendors that I don't have access to because I'm, you know, not buying in this specific neighborhood every single day. And they are. There's a lot of value that they have. And that message got lost to, hey, this person opens the door and fills out a contract. And that couldn't be further from what a good agent does.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is a little bit of the ramifications or results of the surge we had after COVID, where people were just opening doors, making money, basically. Yeah. Where I think if this role were in place and we have a hot market, I do think buyer's commissions start to get pretty constrained at that point. At the same time, even in that market, Melissa and I did a good job of negotiating to actually win deals in a hot market. So like there was value there, but I think that value would then be compensated by the buyer in those hot markets, right? I think the sellers would not feel the need to compensate buyer's agents. So it's going to be interesting as the market shifts to see where we are, because we're kind of, obviously market's going to be location is specific, but you know, in general, right now we're seeing a relative lull. Like we're looking at sub 2008 levels as far as, you know, transactions and everything. Right. Hopefully we're on the rise and kind of a lot of indicators we're looking at. But when we transition back to a hot market, this is going to be really interesting to see what is actually being offered then.
Or, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. As soon as this turns into a no kidding sellers or a buyers, or I'm sorry, as soon as this turns into a buyer's market, where the sellers are like, holy crap, there's five houses on my street that are for sale. They all look better than mine. What am I doing? That's when the value of a buyer's agent, it couldn't be more clear. Like if you have a qualified buyer who's willing to purchase a property in this neighborhood, all six of those listings on that street are going to be beating down the door, trying to offer more and more money. You know, or that's what I think would happen.
When it's easier to get the listing than it is to find the buyer, right? Like what's more difficult at any given time? That indicates the market, right? So if it's harder to actually make a sale and find the buyer, then buyer's agents are going to be worth more.
Yep.
When it's harder to find listings because inventory is low, then listing agents are going to have more worth at that point because, you know, the buyer demand's there, but the listings aren't there. So like I said, it's going to be interesting to see how it normalizes. In the end, what I pull away from it is this is definitely going to change the way operations are run. Like, don't get me wrong, there is a change in the market, but fundamentally what we're doing as agents is not changing. You need to show your value. You need to prove your value. And I think in our EXP call we had the other day, they said it really well, is the biggest shift is we now need to start treating our buyers like we treat our sellers, right? We need to have that conversation up front, understanding what our relationship is, understanding what the compensation looks like and who may compensate, whether it's sellers or buyers. And that's really the biggest change, just justifying your value and making sure it's as clear as possible up front of how that compensation is going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Melissa, so now kind of wrapping us up, if you were having a conversation, which we're going to have this conversation with our team tomorrow, but what are you telling these agents who are worried about whether or not they're going to have a job in 6 months?
Yeah, just about, you know, educating your buyer and explaining that process. It's easier for us, as in JD, Matt, and I, just because we're so investor heavy that, you know, our buyers won't freak out or view this as some big crazy, because, you know, they understand the whole process. So, but if I was doing, you know, like VA, or I dealt with a lot of people buying their forever homes, you know, I would definitely be educating myself as much as possible on everything that they had on training, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think you have to have the conversation with your client to dispel all of the bullshit headlines that we're seeing and give them the facts of the situation and how it's going to affect them.
Yeah, too. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, the mass hysteria that's currently going on, it's going to die down eventually, but you will have to dispel a lot of rumors, a lot of kind of the hearsay that I'm sure some of the objections we're going to talk about overcoming that people over the next coming weeks and months, especially as July hits and it makes it official, you know, if it all goes through. I think it's going to be interesting just to hear some of the ridiculous comments that are starting to come down the pipe that we'll have to overcome. Oh, I didn't realize realtors existed anymore. Well, yeah, that was just a headline. It's not true.
okay, and so that's for the agent. Now, Matt, as far as for the consumer on the buy side and the sell side, what do you think it means for them moving forward?
I don't think it's... My biggest concern is for the low income people. I think, you know, a typical people who have cash, you know, moderate to high income earners, I don't see a massive change. I see negotiations still happen. I see buyer's agents still existing and earning their worth. I think the biggest concern here and change is going to be for the low income consumers when they're buying and selling ultimately. It's going to be really interesting, especially if the market's tight. We will start to, I think, have more conversations. Like, I have a listing right now that's a good example that, you know, it's a 6% listing. But he's at a break-even point right now with his sales price. But if I could negotiate down to say a 2.5% commission on my end and not offer anything to the buyer's rep, we can reduce that price to something that can actually sell. But right now we're priced a little bit too high, and he knows it, I know it, and we're just trying to see if we can still get it moved. But in those scenarios, you know, maybe it's worth it. Maybe it's worth it for someone like him to not offer compensation because he's out still able to offer a price that hopefully can move. It's going to be interesting to see how it shifts, though.
Yeah, good example.
That is a good example. I mean, as it stands right now, nobody would know that it's a 0% commission. So maybe that would help, especially if somebody has buyers looking for that perfect house and that one happens to be it.
So going forward as a consumer, it's most consumers aren't going to understand. Most traditional retail buyers are not going to listen to podcasts like this or even understand. They might see the occasional headline, maybe, and that's it. They might even not even think about it. So I think it's going to, as buyers, it's going to be interesting with like the internet lead sources, the Zillow leads, the BiggerPockets leads. And as these things come down, you need to have that conversation with the buyers up front saying, hey, like, here's how it works now. Like, you know, we can't just go open a door for you and hope that, you know, you work with us and we get paid per the MLS's agreement. Like, we need to have an agreement of compensation up front. And so, like I said, I think it's really just transitioned to talk to buyers more like it's like they're sellers, you know, having a little bit more of an in-depth conversation and understanding up front.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Matt, if any of our listeners wanted to find out more about you or get in connection with you personally, where can we send them?
Sure. I'm on all the socials at Roar Gardener, if you want to find me there, or roargardener.com. Hopefully have my book coming out soon. Final round of editing here, which is we're coming down close. So, hopefully by the end of April, I think it'll be out. I've been saying that for literally a year now, but I'm actually coming to the close now. So looking forward to that.
We can't wait to read it and get to see all that. Matt, we really appreciate your time today.
Always, guys. Always great to chat with you.
Thanks, Matt.
I'll see you guys.
Thank you for listening to The Real Estate Jam. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information, check out our website, therealestatejam.com. Or find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at The Real Estate Jam. If you have any questions, feel free to drop us an email at therealestatejam@gmail.com. See you next episode.